ills of this world should never be forgotten.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
People who limit the Quran to worshipping and personal matters haven't understood it. This is a part of a speech delivered on April 14, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the annual Ramadan Quranic meeting. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of a number of prominent Quranic reciters.
Allah the Exalted Himself teaches us how to speak to Him. So, from the beginning, in the name of Allah the Beneficent, the Merciful, to the end it guides, shows the straight path, the path of those on whom you have bestowed your grace. The Holy Quran, chapter 1, verse 6 to 7. The straight path is the path of those people on whom God has bestowed His grace. They are people who did not deviate from the straight path and who did not provoke the wrath of God. Also in the beginning of Surah Al-Baqarah, God speaks of Quranic guidance. Alif Lam Mim. This is the book, in it is sure guidance, without doubt, to the Muttaqeen. Chapter 2, verse 1 to 2. Therefore, the Quran begins with Quranic guidance, and there are many other parts as well, tens of other ayahs, when God speaks of Quranic guidance and assistance.
Ramadan, ya shahr al-Quran, fika adhuku halawat al-Iman. La tanqadi, anta lil-ruhi dawa. Ramadan, 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 ya Habib, Ramadan. ليتك دوما قريب.
And Quranic guidance is not particular to a special group. The Quran is addressed to all of humanity. It claims that it wants to guide all humans towards the straight path and the correct lifestyle, which will lead to the correct destination. This is no less than a message to all the worlds. The Holy Quran, chapter 38, verse 87. Well, there is a fundamental point here. Quranic guidance is not confined to a particular area of human life. Rather, it covers the whole sphere of human life. In other words, it is not the case that the Quran guides us in one part of life, but leaves us alone and adopts an indifferent approach in any other essential area of life.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new commission is investigating Jair Bolsonaro's response to the pandemic, says Andrew Fishman, author, in an article titled "Brazil seeks to hold Bolsonaro accountable for more than 400,000 COVID-19 deaths." Stay tuned for more. Brazil's COVID-19 crisis remains one of the worst in the world, and a brutal economic depression has forced millions into poverty. Opinion polls are for the first time consistently showing that a majority of Brazilians now disapprove of Bolsonaro. So far, Bolsonaro has proven adept at co-opting public institutions and avoiding accountability through threats, promises, backroom negotiations, or placing loyalists into official positions. But when Brazil's Senate launched a new inquiry into Bolsonaro's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, the president's allies were unable to block it. The panel convened for the first time recently, and members expect the investigation to produce impeachable evidence of his malfeasance. The commission appears ready for a serious probe into the coronavirus response in Brazil. It is a true health, economic, and political tragedy, and the main responsibility lies with the president, said Senator Humberto Costa, an opposition member of the commission. Costa, who is also a former health minister, told The Intercept that he believes there is enough evidence to include that Bolsonaro committed crimes against humanity, a label that other analysts have also used. With October 2022 presidential elections already looming, things could get worse for a man who has now spent years as an indomitable force in Brazilian politics. As Brazil moves closer to election season, anything is possible. The president's future will depend on his ability to maintain his tenuous alliances and the appearance of electability. He may finally be accountable, either in Congress or at the polls, for his dismal handling of the country's response to COVID-19, which had killed over 400,000 Brazilians in a recent account. Congressional leadership allied with Bolsonaro blocked congressional hearings into the government's handling of the pandemic for over a year, ignoring overwhelming evidence of its catastrophic consequences. Despite having enough signatures, the Senate commission that began recently only moved forward after a decision by the Supreme Court forced the issue. Bolsonaro was reportedly furious at the decision and openly lashed out against the justice responsible for ruling. The Brazilian media has already uncovered a slew of scandals related to the government's handling of the pandemic, which will provide the panel with much to look into. Additional investigative powers promise to provide even more public evidence of Bolsonaro's mishandling of the crisis. A detailed study of the government's COVID-19 response by the University of Sao Paulo and the Human Rights Group found that the Bolsonaro administration implemented an institutional strategy to propagate the virus, something the author said was intentional. Many influential voices, including Supreme Court Minister Gilmar Mendes, have referred to the government's actions as genocide since early in the crisis. This month, the Brazilian Bar Association argued that Bolsonaro is committing crimes against humanity. A similar case was submitted to the International Criminal Court last July by a coalition of groups representing over 1 million medical professionals. The Senate panel will review the evidence that led experts to draw these conclusions and has subpoena power to call witnesses and uncover official documents. Bolsonaro has done just about everything in his power to help the coronavirus kill as many Brazilians as possible. As president, he has forcefully discouraged mask use, rejected offers from vaccine manufacturers, fought against lockdowns, held back federal funds to fight the virus, actively promoted ineffective treatments with dangerous side effects, and slashed funding for science and health. When backed into a corner, he has repeatedly suggested that he could use the military to impose martial law or even undertake a coup d'etat if pushed too far. The commission's role is to illuminate all dark areas in the fight against the pandemic, said Senator Renan Caro, recently after being voted in as the commission's rapporteur. The specter of the commission, he said, has already accelerated a series of administrative measures in the last few days that had been frozen. Brazil, which is lagging behind in vaccinations, has suffered over 400,000 coronavirus-related deaths, one of the highest tolls in the world, and has become an international pariah as well as a prime breeding ground for new variants of the disease. The collapse of healthcare systems and overflowing symmetrics have made global headlines and spread the devastation across South America. Disentangling the who's, what's, and whys will be no easy task, especially as the president's allies will work to stymie the investigation at every turn. Of particular interest will be revealing why Brazil ignored or rejected initial offers to procure millions of doses of vaccines on at least 11 separate occasions, as well as how much of Brazil's failure to combat the disease has been due to deliberate policy or administrative incompetence and ideological delusion. Costa, the senator, believes that Bolsonaro deliberately acted to spread the virus. The government decided that the best way to overcome the pandemic was to allow as many people as possible to be contaminated and thereby generate what is called natural immunity from infection without considering the damage this would cause, Costa said. He also attributed some decisions to the crude, intellectually limited vision of Bolsonaro and his government mixed with far-right ideological beliefs. Costa believes that the panel will conclude that impeachable offenses were committed by Bolsonaro, but is skeptical that it will result in impeachment. Unsurprisingly, the Brazilian economy faltered. The official unemployment rate is now a record 14.2% and in reality is likely much higher. The Brazilian real was the world's third worst performing currency last year as foreign investment fled the country and industries ground to a halt. New data suggests that 11 million Brazilians have crossed the line into extreme poverty since the pandemic began, a 45% increase, while the nation simultaneously minted 10 new billionaires. In an effort to hide the true extent of the economic carnage, the government recently cut 98% of the funding for the national census scheduled for this year, which could be cancelled as a result.
Debate. Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kabatak Wai. In the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied Palestine, some 28 Palestinian families are facing the threat of forceful evictions from the neighborhood. Palestinian homes and structures in the area are being demolished for the construction of a new Israeli settlement outpost. That is part of a regular occurrence that happens in the occupied territories. Now, in this edition of the debate, we will look at why Israel can go ahead and break international law this way, while it also continues its efforts to Judaize Jerusalem outputs. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of the debate. We have Mick Knapp here from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. And we also have Saad Nim, who's a professor of political science at Bridgette University, who joins us. I'd like to welcome you both. If I may start with you, Mick Knapp here. As I mentioned just now, the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood is an example in occupied Palestine. You're having 20 Palestinian families facing this threat of evictions, and they're going to be replaced, or that area be placed with new settlements. First of all, isn't this against international law?
Well, yes. It's against international on many, many different levels. Look, this has been going on for so many years. Before I was barred from going to Palestine by the Israelis, I visited Sheikh Jarrah, and there was a resistance tent erected there because people were, many, many years ago, threatened with you know, being dispossessed. And what struck me, and it's one of the things that you never forget, is that the little children went to school in those days and they took their precious toys with them because they were afraid when they came home their house might be demolished or they might be locked out of it. And it's that situation of living in fear which is the lot of Palestinians in this part of Jerusalem. And it's not just some local, petty Hitler. This is government policy. And at the top echelons of the government, there's no doubt about it. There's open, I mean, in which other country in the world would you find open discussion, not just in low-life bars, but in university departments, that there are too many Jews in this area and we have to get rid of them, or there are too many black people. We have a problem with racism in Britain, but we don't have open discussion and university seminars on how to get rid of a certain ethnic group. That's the reality of Israel. The plan to Judaize Jerusalem, to make life hellish for Palestinians and drive out as many as possible, is not a secret. It's absolutely known to all concerned. And this latest ratcheting up of pressure on 28 families is because they are Palestinians. If they were Jews from America or anywhere in the world, it's conceivable that this could happen to them in Israel. This is apartheid on steroids. This is, of course, a version of apartheid which made, I think it was Desmond Tutu, who knew a thing about these things, to say, compared to what the Palestinians were going through in South Africa, hellish as it was, he said it was a picnic.
Well, Sadnim, what is interesting is, according to the ICC, and this is something that's not maybe very well known, the forcible transfer of population and associated war crimes and crimes against humanity actually fall within the Rome Statute. Can you break that open for us as to the depth of what Israel is doing, how the ICC sees it as possible war crimes?
Look, let's put things in perspective. It is a war crime. It is ethnic cleansing. And we should name it in the exact name of ethnic cleansing. And ethnic cleansing is a war crime, not only as described by the United Nations, by all encyclopedias, as well as the ICC. Now, what the ICC could do about it, I think that the Palestinian now had put forward the issue of Sheikh Jarrah in front of the ICC also, in addition to the other cases in front of the ICC. But from our perspective and the world perspective, I would agree with Mick in Edinburgh, who said that it's not silent and it's not invisible. It's visible to everyone around the world, and no one is doing anything. This is the hypocrisy which is going on. If any case of ethnic cleansing had happened in anywhere, as it happened in Rwanda or in Bosnia, the whole world was involved, and they wanted to end this issue in a way or another, because this is a war crime. But once it comes to Israel, no one is doing anything about it. 28 homes are going to be demolished, and the people will be evacuated. We are talking about almost nearly 500 people are going to be evacuated from Sheikh Jarrah, under the pretension that before 1948 this area was Jewish families living there, and they claim the land and they claim the property. What about the Palestinian property in West Jerusalem? What about all the properties that we lost everywhere in Israel now? No one is talking about that. But when it comes to the Palestinians, yes, the Israeli court is absolutely, as a part of the occupation system, is ruling against the Palestinians in order to get them out of Sheikh Jarrah. Not only this issue, but in June we are coming also for another court for another area called Kubaniyat Imharoun, which is another neighborhood in Sheikh Jarrah, also under the same situation, and it will be going to be evicted, and evacuation of the Palestinian there, and they will claim the land to build a new settlement there. We have to mention also that in Sheikh Jarrah, within these 28 houses, already four families were evicted, and no one did anything about it. Now we are leaving that to Jerusalem people, to the Jerusalemite, to the young men of Jerusalem who are fighting face to face with the Israeli, with their naked chests, with nothing in their hands but their faith in their rights in Jerusalem, to defend the neighborhood of Jerusalem. We have to do something about it. Tomorrow is the final day, Thursday, and tomorrow will be the final ruling of the court, and it should take the ruling against the Palestinian as usual, because again, the courts in Israel are absolutely part of the occupation when it comes to the Palestinians. So what we are looking now is not only the ICC, we are pleading to the whole international community, who are always talking about democracy and about human rights, and they are giving us all these ethical lessons. Please now do some of your ethical lessons to what's going on in Jerusalem and stop the hypocrisy that is going on when it comes to Israel.
Okay. McNapp here, you know, you in your previous statements there talked about government policy, and you also threw in the word Judaism in there. I'd like to ask you whether there is an actual concrete plan that has been enshrined perhaps in the pages somewhere of Israeli cabinets where they follow a blueprint, and it has many different ways of what amounts to changing the demographics of the occupied territories to their liking. And Jerusalem al-Quds perhaps is one of the many areas where they do this, and through different methods. Can you tell us what those methods are? And if you agree with the way I worded this in my outlook here.
No, it's a very good question, because the Israeli upper echelons are often very careful about committing to paper obvious criminality. The desire, the commitment to ridding Palestine of its Palestinians and replacing them with Jewish Zionists from around the world, it is as old as Theodor Herzl. And that's never been challenged since then by the leading bodies in Zionism. And the record shows that before 1948, but since 1948, not a week has gone by, but some property in Palestine has changed hands. Sometimes vast amounts of property, sometimes only a few dunams. But the trend is invariably week after month after year that the property moves from being Palestinian property. It remains Palestinian property, but it is seized by the Israeli state and put into a category that it can only be for Jews, that Palestinians may not live on it, may not lease, certainly may not buy it. And this trend has only ever gone one way. High court judges in Israel have pontificated on their benches while living in Palestinian homes, and they have ruled that those homes which have been seized from Palestinians can never be returned to them, but can only be sold to Jews. If you imagine a situation where the mafia controls a state, but then passes laws to justify the theft and pillage and plunder, that's the situation in Israel today. How many of your viewers know that about 94% of Palestine today is out of bounds for purchase or leasing by Palestinians, even Palestinian citizens of Israel? Even those who were trapped inside Israel in 48 and had to become citizens, they are denied access to this, to vast areas of land inside the apartheid state. The situation is one of extreme lawlessness. I mean, of course it's apartheid. Of course it's two sets of laws for Palestinians, one for Jews, one for Palestinians. Of course there are some Jewish-only roads which Palestinians may not travel on. But it's even worse than that. This is a situation where, I've actually visited a place in East Jerusalem where the Palestinian family was living in their own garden. And there were settlers whom I saw. I was a few feet from them. They were sneering and jeering at the Palestinian family. I think they had American accents. And they were living in the home which had been taken over by the state and ordered to be given to them. It is beyond the language of anyone except a poet to convey the horror of what's happening in Palestine. The naked racism, which makes no attempt to hide itself. And I would add, just a Russian proverb, a fish rots from the head. If you look at what's going on at the top of the Israeli government, the openly genocidal language, people like Hotovelli and so on, who's their new ambassador in Britain, she openly calls for the expulsion of every last Palestinian, Muslim and Christian, citizen of Israel or not. And it's in front of our faces. And our other guest is absolutely right.
Well, let me ask you that now. Today, let me jump in since we're quickly running out of time. Sorry about that, McNabb here. Sadnib, today we had a number of scholars, religious leaders, and high-ranking officials who talked about the last Friday of the month of Ramadan in terms of what that signifies. And I want to ask you what that day is. Why is it so important? Because you talked about how the world needs to get up on its feet in terms of the international community, I should say the so-called international community, to make sure that these types of things don't happen to Palestine. Tell us what this Friday, a couple days from now, what the name is, what it means, and why is it so important that the world has actually embraced that day and keeps that alive, so to speak, not only just for that day, but also throughout the year.
Yes, thank you for that. And we are approaching now last Friday in Ramadan. And as usual, since late Al-Khomeini make that day as a day of Jerusalem, it became very important. And it's also important for us because now Muslims all around the world, we are talking about millions of Muslims, not only in Iran, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Syria, and other countries in the region, but also in Europe and wherever there are Muslims are doing remembering this day and celebrating this day, the last last Friday of Ramadan, to celebrate Jerusalem and to bring up the idea of Jerusalem. It's well known fact that Jerusalem is not only for the Palestinians. Palestinians definitely are the one who are defending Jerusalem now and face to face with the occupation and with the everyday atrocities by the Israeli Zionist government. But at the same time, Jerusalem is important to all Muslims around the world, as well as also to Christians. Remember that the holy sites are for the Muslims and the Christians equally in Jerusalem. So marking the day of Jerusalem around the world, and especially in Iran, definitely that is giving us a kind of support. Even if it's a moral support for the Palestinians, but we believe that the day will be closer and closer when we really celebrate together in Jerusalem after it is liberated from this colonialist project called Israel in general. The Jerusalem Day, over all the years, it became very controversial for all those who are against either Iran or the bloc, which is the resistance bloc, if you like, in the Arab world, and also against the Palestinians. They don't like it, they don't want to see it, because it reminds them how they are not doing nothing, especially when we are talking about states in the Gulf, that they do nothing to Jerusalem in reality, but at the same time, they are embarrassed of this day when everyone goes into these millions of people going into the street to celebrate this day for Jerusalem and to say that Jerusalem is an Arab Islamic city and it should be come back again under the control of the Palestinian people and for the Arab and the Muslims and to get rid of this occupation and to get rid of this colonial project which was created in 1948 by European decisions at that time, regardless of how racist and how it become today. From racist at that time till today, it became an apartheid regime totally, since now the numbers are talking about the majority of people who are living in historical Palestine are Palestinian, are over the Jewish population. So it is an apartheid regime. It's a racist regime by definition. When Herzl said to create a Jewish state only for Jews, it means that it is by definition Zionist is a racist movement. And if you create a state based on racism, so definitely we are talking about the results will be not only racism and also an apartheid regime.
Okay, since you're talking about apartheid regime there, I'd like to bring you in, McNabb, here for what has happened recently and see whether this is going to get anywhere. And that was something that Human Rights Watch actually gave out, in which it said discrimination against Palestinians by Israeli laws and policies amount to the crimes of apartheid. It was a very long report accusing Israel of operating a system of apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territories, and concluded that in certain areas they amount to the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. Good thing that Human Rights Watch has made that report in the form and manner that it did. But basically, the big question is, how will that translate into action on the ground? I mean, do these types of reports that come out and highlight what Israel is doing, amounting to it being an apartheid regime, make a difference for the lives of Palestinians?
Is that addressed to myself?
Yes.
I don't think it makes a difference to the lives of Palestinians today. I don't think when you look at the fall of other racist systems or other brutal oppressions, they fall suddenly. Life often gets much worse before this nightmare can lift. I think what's key is that the decision by Human Rights Watch so late in the day to say that Israel has become an apartheid state, it's not perfect. Zionism was an apartheid system from its very inception. Before the state was set up, the Jewish colonies were run on an apartheid basis of trying to damage Palestinians as much as possible. But what has happened is, for many years, the Palestinian resistance, the heroism of these young men, and not just young men, the whole population in Jerusalem, has inspired people around the world. And the decision by Human Rights Watch, and an impending decision by Amnesty as well, to reach the same belated conclusion, is a tribute to the heroism of the Palestinian people, their determination against insuperable odds to continue. And that's what's happened. They cannot defeat Israel by force of arms, not while there is an air bridge of weapons from Washington and America, and the EU to Israel. But they have won in a crucial area, and that's world public opinion. Israel is already a polecat state. It's a pariah state. Even those governments which are arming Israel, such as my own, well understand that popular opinion is very, very opposed to that. And the BDS movement, of course, exists to channel that public opinion, which is already there, into actively isolating and weakening the apartheid state. The Palestinians are the inspiration. They are winning, even though it's at tremendous cost.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. That's Mick Knapp here from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. From Edinburgh, also Saad Nirm. Thank you, Professor of Political Science at Brzezet University. We do appreciate your comments. And you don't forget, this Friday is Al-Quds Day rallies that are going to be held and recognition of the plight of Palestinians. We're going to be covering that, I'm sure, for a major portion of the day. It's the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. And, of course, we would like for you to tune in and see what's going on that day. From Mikhail Tafa, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye until the next debate.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The late African-American Muslim minister and human rights activist Malcolm X once suggested that the United States should be prosecuted for the genocidal situation facing black Americans at the United Nations. Decades later, and in the wake of brutal U.S. policing, the United States is now facing similar questions and similar criticisms. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan. Richard Sudan is a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, U.S. Police Killing of Black People Are Indeed a Crime Against Humanity. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sudan's article. For years, the United States has been readily quick to point the finger of blame at other countries and highlight alleged crimes against humanity. This claim is almost always followed by subsequent plans to militarily invade a country, usually in Africa or Middle East, in order to steal resources and to install the US version of so-called democracy. This pattern has continued playing out decade after decade, despite masses of people around the world becoming ever wise to the repeated pretext used by the United States and its allies to justify boots on the ground in countries in which their armed forces are simply not welcome. But now, a damning report produced by a group of international human rights experts has turned the tables on the narrative used by the United States. And as much of world opinion and perception of the country begins to shift, has placed the question of alleged crimes against humanity squarely back within the country's own borders. A special report produced by a commission of experts from 11 countries, which runs to 188 pages, has suggested that the continued systematic killing of African Americans in the United States by police and law enforcement not only amounts to murder, but also fits the definition of crime against humanity, the very same favored assertion which the United States unflinchingly directs towards other countries, often without real substantive evidence. But the new research, which is extensive, argues that the deadly abuse of black people at the hands of law enforcement in the United States amounts to a violation of human rights obligations, whilst operating a culture of impunity around police suspected of murdering black people. The report also points to the US tolerating an alarming national pattern of disproportionate use of deadly force against African Americans. But not only that, the lawyers behind the research are also demanding that the International Criminal Court, the ICC, conduct an immediate investigation into the continued abuse of black people in the United States, describing the cycle of abuse as police murder and torture. For those who are familiar with the phenomena of deadly force in the United States leading to continual grief and anguish in the black community, the report is welcome, concise, and importantly is added vindication to what experts and activists have been arguing for many years. In the same way that deeply entrenched and systemic white supremacy has been revealed for the world to see, especially over the last few months, even acknowledged by the FBI, this new report gives the United States government, which has always backed the police force, nowhere to hide, as international focus, momentum, and demands for justice continue to reverberate and be amplified around the world. But one thing which is likely to be certain is that the findings from this new report will be completely ignored by the US government, which many argue has taken next to no decisive action at all in dealing with the systematic and ongoing abuse of African American and blacks in the United States. While President Joe Biden opportunistically rode the coattails of the black vote in the United States to narrowly beat former President Donald Trump to the White House last November, and while promising on election night to have the backs of the black community, millions view him as having seriously reneged on that promise. Following the murder of George Floyd last year by former police officer Derek Chauvin, millions of people around the world have been closely scrutinizing the United States and asking questions. How can a country which describes itself as a so-called flag bearer of democracy claim to be one when it continues to brutalize and mistreat its own black citizens, whose descendants built the country? This is a valid question indeed. The late African-American Muslim minister and human rights activist Malcolm X once suggested that the United States should be prosecuted at the United Nations for the genocidal situation facing black Americans. Decades later, and in the wake of brutal US policing, the United States is now facing similar questions and similar criticisms. And perhaps these calls will continue to grow louder. Because the deaths of black people at the hands of the state are unrelenting. During and since the trial of Derek Chauvin, dozens more deaths have occurred by uniformed police officers, sparking widespread outrage, including the death of a teenage girl, Makia Bryant. The irrefutable fact is, the United States is in no moral position to speak about crimes against humanity until it gets its own house in order. The US simply must prioritize ending once and for all the systematic killing of African American, particularly men, women and children, at the hands of law enforcement and police, and bring about swift, restorative justice to black communities which deserve nothing less. Democratic Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley says black people are traumatized in the United States, and Derek Chauvin's guilty verdict in Minneapolis hasn't changed anything for them. Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer who knelt on the neck of George Floyd, leading to Floyd's death in May of 2020, has been found guilty on all charges that he faced. The verdict was read in Hennepin County Court recently as Black Lives Matter activists hit the streets to protest rampant police brutality in the United States. Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all three criminal counts he was facing. He faces up to 40 years imprisonment for second-degree murder, up to 25 years for third-degree murder, and up to 10 years for second-degree manslaughter. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley wrote an article recently for USA Today where she said that the outcome of the Derek Chauvin trial doesn't change things for us, because black people are still being killed by police. Ayanna Pressley wrote, "I want to wake up feeling lighter, but I don't. I want to wake up fearing less for the safety of my black husband and black daughter, but I don't. I want to wake up and see nice days for black community, but I don't. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, but I can't. It's a new day in America, but our communities are still facing the same traumas as before." She added, "What I want my colleagues in Congress and at every level of government to understand is that the only thing that matters in this moment is meaningful policy change and budget change, period. It's time to put our money where our mouth is and invest in resources that provide the restorative, trauma-informed, community-based solutions people are demanding. Our communities have already lost too much. Ayanna Pressley concluded by saying, George Floyd was not a martyr. His life was not meant to be a sacrifice. He was a regular person who woke up on a regular morning, went to a regular store, and was murdered in broad daylight, on camera, by regular police. He was somebody. He deserved to grow old. A US-based journalist and political analyst said, the surge in violence against people of color in the United States is a systemic problem rooted in the legacy of slavery and legalized segregation in the US. In a recent interview, Dr. Abayomi Asikiwe said the police practices employed in the United States today have their origins in the slave patrols of the 19th century that were designed to keep incarcerated Africans under the control of white landowners, white merchants and officials.